Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's installment in Jewish art. And is it meaning, is it idolatry or is it symbolism? So we're going to be beginning by starting with cherubs and eventually we'll get to griffins. It'll make sense as we go on. So as far as the general direction of what we're going, we're going to be discussing what did cherubs look like, what did they represent, and can you make depictions of them? And where were they generally used historically, as well as modern day? Where would you, if you were to make artwork, where would you, you know, where would you expect to see these images? So, you're wondering as to how the cherubs fit into the general angelology in Judaism. Please see some of my previous theorem on the supernatural beings in Judaism, where I discuss angels more, just more directly. We're going to be focusing more on the way they look than on the theological aspect of it. But again, some parts it will obviously come up as well. So we're going to begin by going through some of the instances of when kruvim or cherubs come up in Tanakh. So the word kruvim comes up 91 times. So we're not going to go through all 91, or we wouldn't be able to properly explore and explain what they are. So the primary times that you may see them being described, well, the first time is in the Garden of Eden, where the kruvim are used as guardians. But primarily they're used in references in terms of the Mishkan and the Mikdash and their decoration, as well as particularly to the Aron, as well as to the heavenly chariot, Ma'aseh Merkava and Yechezkel. So we will try and get to some of these instances, and then we'll see what Chazal do with it, and then we'll get a little more into the historical aspect of it. So first things first, the first mentioning of the word Tanakh is the guardians to guard Eden. So after Adam and Chava sin, and they're kicked out, so God places the kruvim along with a fiery sword to prevent everybody from getting to the Eitz HaChayim, the tree of life. As far as what exactly the tree of life is and how that is, what that means, please tune in next week when we discuss the Eitz HaChayim. But as far as what kruvim look like, we don't really know much from here. But we start getting more details when we get to the construction of the Mishkan. So here is the most descriptive part where we hear about what the kruvim look like. So this is in terms of the kruvim over the aron. So we are commanded to make two, or more like Moshe was, because he made it, we never remade the aron since, unlike other kelim. For more on that, please see the Machon Mikdash website for why they made some kelim and not others. Certain ones you're permitted to reproduce, other ones are forbidden to be reproduced. So you can make two. You should make two kruvim of gold. Make them hammered work at the two ends of the cover of the aron. Make one cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. Of one piece with the cover, you shall make the kruvim at its two ends. The kruvim shall have their wings spread out above, shielding the cover with their wings. They shall confront each other, the faces of the kruvim being turned towards, here, GPS says the cover, but the question is, Pnehem Ishal Achiv, and then Ela Kaporet. So the question is, so we'll get to the how the faces work out a little bit later. So we know that they have wings, and they have faces, and are facing towards each other, or towards the Aron, unclear which. Okay, but that's what we know so far. They are beings with faces and wings that are on top of the Aron. We also tend to, when God speaks to Moshe, that it comes out from there. Right, so when God is speaking to Moshe, so all the others are going to say that that's where the voice comes out of, where God's divine voice comes out. So far, so good. Okay, what's the music? Here, just unmute. Try you can unmute yourself.
It's yeah.
Just I'm hearing some feedback noises. So okay. So as it sounds right now, Spindle Crew have wings and they have faces and not much more than that about their appearance. But as far as what they look like, so odds are they're not like the very sweet angels you're used to seeing, as we will see in a moment. They're not the angels that you are used to. So, before we get to then here is the depiction from Machon Mikdash for how they think the Aron looked. You could argue, we'll get to that in a second. But again, here's what their depiction of the Aron looks like. Again, and we see there's two Kruvim facing each other a little bit down. Again, exactly why that's the angle we'll see in the Gemara in a little bit. But yeah, just to give some example of this. This is one interpretation. Another, we'll see there's other versions of where the wings face and how that works out. Again, we will see that in a little bit as well. Just figure it out while we're doing.
Can I just ask a general question, which is, this is just curiosity. Did they find other examples of these Kruvim? Did archaeologists find any examples predating the Torah, let's say, of these images, which some could maybe argue that they borrowed from other religions? Or as far as you know, were these kinds of unique for its time period?
We'll get to that in the second half of this year. Worry not.
Okay.
For now, we're addressing the Kruvim in the Mikdash. We will get to the other parallels from other cultures after that. So we mentioned that the Kruvim on the Aron, also you'll note that the Kruvim don't look the same in the Machon Mikdash's images. Again, that's, take that with the Machon Mikdash. These are just an example of what they may have looked like. We don't actually know precisely because, well, we haven't found the Aron yet, and the Parochet has not survived. So, and here also, again, you see, and faces, and wings looks for us like a bird. Also, you may note the lions from last week. There also are eagles on the Parochet. For more on that, if you want an entire lecture just on Nesher and what Nesher is and its symbolism, also please let me know. I'm happy to give you one on that as well. Okay, so as far as what they looked like, the most detailed version we have is actually based on Maaseh Merkava, God's divine chariot. Due to the fact that there is some slight issues halakhically with learning it in depth, so we're going to go with the English, simply because A, the Hebrew doesn't make much sense any more than the English does, and B, because it'll simply save us a lot of time. And there's a lot of words, and it's actually two slides, all the details. Okay, so again, it's mentioned multiple times. It's mentioned in the first chapter of Yechezkel. It's mentioned in the 10th chapter of Yechezkel. Comes up again in the 17th chapter of Yechezkel. Again, comes up a lot. What the angels and the Kruvim look like. So we have in the past the first chapter of Yechezkel. So now I figured it's a good time as any to try the 10th chapter and see if it makes any more sense to us. It might not, which is perfectly fine. Who thinks that they are ready to delve into the secrets of the of the angels? Anybody willing to give it a shot? Two halves to the chapter, one on this slide, one on the next. So you can volunteer for only one. You don't need to take both.
I looked, and on the expanse over the heads of the cherubs, there was something like a sapphire stone, an appearance resembling a throne that could be seen over them. He spoke to the man clothed in linen and said, "Step inside the..." Can't see the word.
Oh, sorry.
Steel? Wheel? Wheelwork? Steelwork?
Yes, wheelwork.
Wheelwork under the cherubs, and fill your hands with glowing coals from among the cherubs and scatter them over the city. And he went in as I looked on. Now the cherubs were standing on the south side of the house when the man entered, and the cloud filled the inner court. But when the presence of the Lord moved from the cherubs to the platform of the house was filled with cloud, and the court was filled with radiance of the presence of the Lord. The sounds of the cherub's wings could be heard as far as the outer court, like the voice of El Shaddai when he speaks. when he commanded the man dressed in linen, take fire from among the cherubs within the wheel work. He went in and stood beside a wheel, and a cherub stretched out his hand among the cherubs to the fire that was among the cherubs. He took some and put it in the hands of him who was clothed in linen, who took it and went out. The cherubs appeared to have the form of a man's hand under the wings. I could see that there were four wheels beside the cherubs, one wheel besides each of the cherubs. As the appearance of the wheels, they gleamed like the beryl stone. In appearance, the four had the same form as if there were two wheels cutting through each other.
Okay. So far, they're the wheels of the heavenly chariot. They're made of fire, and they have coals, and they have hands and wings. Okay. Not that this means much, but that is what we've seen so far. Okay. So, I'll continue then. So, and when they moved, each could move in the direction of any of its four quarters. They did not veer as they moved. The cherubs moved in the direction which one of the heads faced without turning as they moved. So note that there are four faces for a cherub. Okay, notice not the way that we saw depicted so far. Their entire bodies, backs, hands, and wings. So now they have backs, hands, and wings, as opposed to just hands and wings. And the wheels of the four of them, were covered all over with eyes. It was these wheels that I had heard called the wheel work. Each one had four faces. One was a cherub's face, the second a man's face, the third a lion's face, and the fourth an eagle's face. The cherubs ascended. Those were the creatures that I had seen by the Chaver Canal. So that's like the original, that's what we had from the first chapter. Whenever the cherubs went, the wheels were beside them, and when the cherubs lifted their wings to ascend from the earth, the wheels did not roll away from their side. And when those stood still, these stood still, and when those ascended, then these ascended with them, for the spirit of the creature was in them. Then the presence of the Lord left the platform of the house and stopped above the cherubs. And I saw the cherubs lift their wings and rise from the earth, the wheels beside them as they departed, and they stopped the entrance of the eastern gate of the house of the Lord with the presence of the God of Israel above them. They were the same creatures that I had seen below the God of Israel at Chaver Canal. So now I knew that they were cherubs. Each one had four faces and each had four wings with the form of human hands under the wings. As for the form of their faces, they were the very faces that I had seen by the Chaver Canal. Their appearance and their features, each can move in the direction of any of its faces. Okay, so to summarize, features that the Kruvim are described in Yechezkel's having is they have four faces consisting of a cherub, a humans, a lion, and an eagles. They also have multiple sets of wings. They move in multiple directions without actually moving their wings, which is confusing. And they seemingly have an aspect of fire to them. So far, so good? Okay. Yeah, that doesn't help us understand what they actually look like. So as far as what they actually look like, so we're going to get a little more detail from the Gemara, and then hopefully this will help a little bit. Okay, so as far as what their faces look like, you know, at least the cherub face looked. So here we have the Gemara in Sukkah. So as you can tell, the Hebrew is quite short, but of course to explain it in English, it's quite long. So here we have the Cicino translation, William Davidson translation. The Steinsaltz English translation. So now let's see what the Gemara has to say for what these faces look like. So the Gemara asks, what is the face of the cherub, of the kruv? Rabbi Abba said, like that of a child, kiravya in Aramaic. As a Babylonian one calls a child a ravya. So here we go. So as far as your people seeing, babies with wings, so that will be based on a slight corruption of the Gemara, where the Gemara says, well, only the faces look like the babies, but some artists decided, faces are like babies, therefore the whole body is like babies and just has wings. So Abai said to him, but if you say that, Then what is the meaning of that which is written about the faces of celestial beasts and the drawing of the celestial chariot? The face of the first one, the face of the chariot, but the face of the second one, the face of man. Wait, so how does that work? Wait, if we said that the first one looks like the cherub is young, is that of a child, then why is the next one talking about that of a man? Also, in the first chapter of Ezekiel, one of them is the head of a bull. So why did it change? So according to explanation, this face of the cherub is the same as that of the face of a man. So my answer is, although two of the celestial beasts drawing that chariot had the face of a man, the difference between them is that one had a large face and one was a small face. In other words, the face described as the face of a man was the face of an adult, and the face described as the face of a cherub was that of a child. Okay? And this also is the source, on a side note, that the ark and the ark cover were also 10 hand breadths, 10 tachim tall, which is relevant just to note the scale of the Aron. Again, 10 tefachim tall is not very tall. 10 tefachim tall is around between 30 and 40 inches, depending on how you measure your tefach. Or in meters, it's like a meter tall. If that's, yeah. Okay? So that's as far as what the face looked like. Again, so it's saying that a cherub face is the face of a child. Okay, so that's, so as far as all those faces, so true, the angels may have had four faces, but the face that's specifically referred to as a kruv is that of a child's face. So now we have a little more details as to what a kruv looked like. And then the other question is, so where were they facing? We saw there's a little bit of ambiguity in regards to, you know, how the kruvim stood on top of the aron, whether they were, you know, facing each other, facing the aron, depending on how you parsed the verse in Shemot. So here's the Gemara. Bavram's work continues on in that vein. So explaining that the contradiction. So one is says their face towards each other. This is the contradiction between the verse in Shemot and the verse in Chronicles. Okay, so the verse in Shemot, which you read already, says that they face towards each other. But on the other hand, in Chronicles, it says they face towards the house, i.e. the sanctuary. Gemara asks, but according to the one who says their faces are turned towards one another, isn't it written their faces are towards the house? Then how does it mean? Then how does he explain the meaning of this verse? Gemara answers, this is not difficult, as their faces miraculously change directions in reflection of the Jewish people's relationship to God. Here, when it states that the cherubs faced each other, it was when the Jewish people do the will of God. There, the verse that describes that the cherubs faced the sanctuary and not towards each other was when the Jewish people did not do the will of God. So that's where we get the, as you may have heard the Midrash, that when the Jews were doing the right thing, then the angels, the Kruvim, looked at each other. When not, then they turned away from each other. The Gemara asks, according to the one who says that they stood as is described in the verse, their faces were towards the house, isn't it written, and the faces towards each other? So how could you have both? So how does he explain it? Rather, they were angled sideways so that they turned both towards each other and towards the sanctuary at the same time, as it is taught in the Braita, that Unkelos the convert said that the cherubs were made in the form of children. As the verse states, and the Holy of Holies made two kruvim in the form of children and overlaid them with gold. So as far as the source of the kruvim being children, so the source is actually in Divrei Yamim, not from the Torah, that's not entirely clear, nor from Yecheskel. Their faces were angled sideways toward the Ark of the Covenant, like a student taking leave of his teacher. So in that way, it was both facing towards each other, they were facing towards each other while not facing towards each other. Hence the slight bent and angled perspective. Okay, so now we know the way that the Kruvim on the Aron faced. Okay, and there's another issue here, is that we have, well, that's very good now that we know what the top of the Aron looked like. But there's only one slight issue, that there's another set of Kruvim in the Mikdash created by Shlomo Melech that is much bigger than the Aron. So the Aron was, we mentioned, was 10 tefachim tall. So, or 10 tefachim, then 10 tefachim on top of it again for the kruvim. But there's also, there's another issue, is that Shlomo constructed some quite large kruvim to accompany the Aron and the Beit HaMikdash in the first temple. So would somebody like to read these about these other kruvim that were constructed and whether or not we think that they look the same or not? And we want to give it a try?
Read if you want. He made two sculptured kruvim in the Holy of Holies, and they were overlaid with gold. The outspread wings of the kruvim were 20 cubits across, one wing 5 cubits long, touching one wall of the house, and the other wing 5 cubits long, touching the wing of the other kruv. One wing of the other kruv, 5 cubits long, extending to the other wall of the house, and its other wing 5 cubits long, touching the wing of the first kruv. The wing spread of these kruvim was thus 20 cubits across, and they were standing up facing the house. I'm confused, but...
Yes. So here, so to make a little more sense of it, so we have, so these are, they're quite large. Okay. Because 5 cubits is, so that's 2.5 meters is the wingspan of each wing. So their wingspan of each is then 5 meters. Basically a cubit is 0.5 meter. So that helps. Okay. So they're quite large in terms of, to give a case of perspective. So here is again, Machon Mikdash. Okay, so this is the way that they interpreted it. Okay, so here we have the kruvim with these really long, large wings, and they go with the 6 wing set as per the first chapter of Yechezkel. Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
If this wasn't directly directed by God to be made, just seeing the picture, it really looks like idols. Like, well, how could Shlomo do that without divine directive?
So, good question. So, typically it's assumed that all the additions that Shlomo did were approved by God, because God, because he had a prophet at the time, and God did not say otherwise. So, even though it's not explicitly written in the text that you know, he asked God for every decision, the assumption is that God approved his decisions. So yes, would we be allowed to nowadays, you know, construct these? The answer is no, very much no. As we'll see in a little bit, but
it seems like philosophically wrong. Like, just, you know what I'm saying?
Correct. But then there are, the first is the most common decoration of the walls throughout the Mishkan and walls of the Beit Hamikdash was kruvim, right? Embroidered like everywhere. So we'll get to why this isn't necessarily idolatry and why this is fine in just a second. We'll see that the Rambam will give a good explanation for why there's two. I want to certainly help explain for why Shlomo decided to add more things. Shlomo also, you know, added more of all of the other kelim of the Beit Hamikdash. Also, he added, you know, 10 shulchans also, the showbread tables, I guess, would be the way to the best way to describe them. He added 10 more. Same with the menorah. He added 10 more. Why? It's a good question, but he did. So
how many kruvim were there? It says in this picture, there are 4 altogether. There are 2 on the
These are the 2. Right. So there's 2 on top of the aron, and then there's the 2 that are surrounding the aron. To the right and the left, not including the ones that are engraved on, that are, embroidered on the parochet, as well as elsewhere on the walls of the Beit Hamikdash. So you don't see them in this picture. But yeah, for more on that, again, highly recommend looking at Machon Hamikdash, both on their website as well as they also have Machzorim where they have pictures of, let's say, for Yom Kippur, where they have the whole, where they go into far more detail. Okay? Right? Again, so yes, it does look very idolatrous, which we'll get to in a second, which is why we generally don't make them. Right? Unless God says make this, we tend to not make this. So, you'll see here. So here, this is the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, so this is in Yeridah. So we're talking about in general what you're allowed to make and not make, and what's idolatrous versus not idolatrous. So this is just one excerpt. There's quite a few examples of what you can and can't make. So here we are going to explain what you can and can't make in regards to duplicating that of the of what you've seen above, which is, as we read in Shavuot, there's a problem of making things of what you saw of God at Har Sinai, or in general, just of anything, period, is a problematic to make, even more so when it's actively worshipped and looks like it's an idol. So somebody so there's alternating paragraphs between the Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch, and the Ramah, right? So, right, Reviews of Cairo versus Moshe Israelis, so alternating paragraphs. So as you'll see, the Mechaber, Reviews of Cairo, is a little more Machmir than the Ramah, Moshe Israelis. So who would like to read the odd paragraphs, and who would like to read the even paragraphs? Who is very anti, I see Karen is very anti, who is here is very anti making art. They can read the odd paragraphs. Anybody?
I'll read whichever one you want.
You go for the odd paragraphs. Someone wants to read the Ramah, the even paragraphs.
Hold on, you want me to read the first or the second?
Start with the first one, and then I think Elaine will read the second and fourth. So read the first.
Okay. We're good here, Elaine and I. Okay, it is forbidden to create images of the dwelling place of the divine presence, such as the four faces. Similarly, the images of Seraphim, Ophanim, and other angels. Similar, the images of man alone. All of these are forbidden to make, and if a non-Jew made them, you cannot keep them.
Ramah. But if you find them, you're permitted to keep them, except for the sun, moon, stars that idolaters worship, or if there is proof they were worshipped, then all sculptures are forbidden.
What is forbidden? When it juts out sculpture, but sunken in, such as when weaving a garment or drawing on a wall, is permitted. You can never make a sun, moon, and stars. If it is to teach, then it is permitted, even sculpture.
Ramah, some permit it in public, as there is no worry of idolatry worship.
Okay. So as it looks right now, if you wanted to make a, would you wanted to make a duplicate to what Shlomo made of the Kruvim, would that be permitted? Sculpture.
Yes.
Sculpture? Could you make a statue of an angel? So it looks like no, in terms of making a sculpture, right? Sculptures are a no-go, but as far as a painting, probably be okay. So, but that's as far, but there's also this like caveat of if you're making something, if you find something that was worshipped, then that's a problem and it's going to be forbidden. So another question we might want to look into is, what is the goal of having them there in the first place? So for this, we have the Mor Nevuchim, God is perplexed. We also saw it quoted by others, last week as well, two weeks ago in regards to the lions. So why would you want to have these seemingly angelic figures and a pair of them? So this is after the Rambam went through explaining why angels are important and why we care about them. So now that he explained, you know, how the whole angelology works and how God operates through angels and why that's not idolatry. Now he's going to explain why it's important that we have angels and their images throughout the Beit HaMikdash. So from the preceding remarks, again, this is the Friedlander translation because I don't speak Judeo-Arabic, and if somebody here does, please let me know, because I've got some questions for you. So from the same remarks, it is clear that the belief in the existence of angels is connected with the belief in the existence of God. The belief in God and angels leads to the belief in prophecy and in the truth of the law. In order to firmly establish this creed, God commanded the Israelites to make over the ark the form of two angels. The belief in the existence of angels is thus inculcated into the minds of the people. And this belief is in importance next to belief in God's existence. It leads us to believe in prophecy and in the law and opposes idolatry. If there had only been one figure of a cherub, the people would have been misled and would have mistaken it for God's image, which was not to be worshipped, in the fashion of the heathen. Or they might have assumed that the angel represented by the figure was also deity, and would thus have adopted a dualism. By making two kruvim, and distinctly declaring the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, Moses clearly proclaimed the theory of the existence of a number of angels. He left no room for the error of considering that those figures are as deities, since he declared that God is one and that he is the creator of the angels, who are more than one. Okay, so as far as so the Rambam is specifically referring to why there's two Kruvim on the Aron, but the logic could be explained for why there's many depictions of Kruvim throughout, as well as on Parochet and elsewhere. It's because the reason, and also they typically come in pairs and not in a singular version, singular groove, because if you have a single groove, you might be confused to think that it's an item of worship. Once it's in pairs, we're no longer concerned anymore, because now it's quite clearly referring to the angels, and it's simply a depiction of angels, and whether or not angels have true physical form or not is, again, subject to a previous lecture we had, which was linked earlier. If you'd like, if you'd like to look more into that, please check back at that last lecture.
Yeah, I actually thought the Rambam would use the same reason he spoke about sacrifices, that the reason there were sacrifices is to wean the Jewish people away from the idol worship and the custom of the people in those times. So maybe similarly, the Egyptians had these images, and maybe that also kind of weaned them away from it. It doesn't seem to be going in that direction.
We will see that in just a minute, or a couple minutes. We're going to get there, don't worry. Okay, so until now we've been ignoring Sammy's very good questions and points about the rest of the ancient Near East, did they not have similar things? So for that, let's start by talking a little about the etymology of a kruv. So this is from the Jewish Encyclopedia, from 1906. This particular entry was done by, I can click it and find out. Anyways, by some very scholars you may have heard of, such as Louis Ginsberg, known for his, these are serious scholars from, a century ago. So some of the options that they offered was what does Kruvu come from? So again, these are all ancient Near East comparisons. One says that it's compared to the Assyrian Kruvu, or Shedu, which is the name of the winged bull. Okay, so again, we're getting periodologists pretty fast here. Okay, that's the first suggestion. Okay, then there's also, the list continued and connected with the Assyrian Karubu, which is great or mighty. Alternatively, it's the opposite of the Hebrew Barech in reverse. So simply, it's just saying that it's that sometimes words get reversed, and that's all it really is. So another option is that it connects to the Greek word griffus. Okay. So, or in Hindu, this would be the Garuda. Okay, so this is the griffin. So as far as now the question would then become, well, what is that and why is the griffin connected to the kruv? So here comes the slightly more irreverent section of the lecture. Okay, here we go. Let's see, hope everybody enjoys this part of the class, because if anybody has any, feel free to ask questions at any point if anything seems unclear, because it's going to get a little complicated. As far as, based on what we mentioned before, to the griffin, actually let's look forward a bit, then I'll go back. So here, so if you're looking for a griffin, so you see here, we this came up 2 weeks ago, the what you shouldn't do. You see here, this is an arc in Eastern Europe. So you see these animals with the wings and the horn. So this is something you should not make. Okay, so here, this is the Shun Hechel Yitzchak, or the Yitzchak HaLevi Herzog, the second Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel. So in a tshuva where he's asked, people are asking if they want to decorate their shul, they wonder what they could put in it. So he went there explaining why it's okay to put in lions and how to properly do so. And now he's explaining why you can't put in a griffin. On the other hand, the example you sent me of a lion with wings, that I absolutely prohibit, because it is taken from figurines of ancient civilizations and the sources of mythological deity. Blessed is he who uprooted the idolatry from these lands, and God forbid, shouldn't moralize them in our houses of prayer, nor should they be mentioned. If you want to make a lion to represent bravery like a lion, serve a father above, please do it like the image I presented, meaning only make one side of the body and not the full form and without the wings. Okay, so here we see, right, of Herzog very clearly saying, don't make a griffin, meaning the lion with wings. And if you're gonna make a lion to begin with, make sure that you don't make it look like a full figure of a lion. Make sure it's a clearly, you know, basically two-dimensional looking, even if it is made, even if it's sculpted on your aron, because, well, we don't want to accidentally put idolatry in the middle of our shuls. As far as so he was very much not happy with anybody doing this. He's like, this is idolatry straight up. Okay, as far as what do we mean by it's idolatry? So again, so say from Wikipedia, a griffin is a legendary creature with the body, tail, and back legs of a lion, and the head and wings of an eagle, and sometimes an eagle's talons at its front feet. Okay, so, and as far as when did it creep into Judaism, so for instance, there aren't many references to griffins in Jewish texts in general. So one of them is there is a reference to a Rosh, which I didn't bring for you, but here's one of the main sources where we bring it at length is the in regards to describing the temple, the throne of Solomon. Okay, so this is from a work called Midrashim on King Solomon. The throne of the Hippodrome of King Solomon, or the Hebrew is So the question is, you know, what is going on? So then, again, as mentioned, as I wrote there, it's first published 872 based on a manuscript of unclear dating, so we're unclear how old this Midrash is and whether or not, and like from where it came from. Because it's also the only reference we have to this Midrash. So domesticated wild animals and birds were held in the throne, impure opposite pure, a lion opposite an ox, a deer on the right, an elephant on the left, or aim, either oryx and aryx, on the right, and the graphis on the left, and a man standing at the end of all of them. Rabbi Yochanan said, how did Solomon arise and sit on his throne? The ox would take him with his horns and pass him to the lion, and the elephant to their aim to the graphis to the man, and they would say in a loud voice, we have delivered you completely. Rabbi Yochanan said, they would all raise their voices, and the earth would tremble, the ox would bellow, the lion would roar, and the graphs would shout, and the man would sing. We later said, how did Solomon sit on his throne? He would take a Torah and look at it, and their aim would recite, and these are the laws, and the graphs would recite, and you shall judge between man and his friend. Okay, so a little weird, a little cryptic, doesn't tell us anything about what a graphis is. But as far as what a graphis is, this is so we know what a griffin is, which is a relatively similar pronunciation. And we also know that there's a whole bunch of other examples of these of similar type images in the ancient Near East. For instance, here we have the Assyrian Lamassu. This is from Sargon, meaning the father of Sancheriv's chamber. Again, as you can tell, this very much could pass for right, this is very idolatrous looking. Yes, right. So we see, you know, body of an ox, wings of it's got wings, got an animal, it's got a human face on it, right? Very, right. This is one of the deities of an Assyrian god. Also, you see here. So here, and according to Jewish encyclopedia, right? So here are Assyrian forms that they call them kruvim because it's a hybrid between a bird and an animal, and used in a semi-deified part of their religion. So you may note some of these are approaching looking a little bit like the Kruvim that we saw earlier. Yeah, now not quite so much.
What dates would you say these are approximately?
This is the Sancheriv. So these are the Syrian forms are dated to 2,800 years ago. So again, this is later. Then the Egyptian forms predate by several hundred years, right? Such as Horus, that's one down here. The ones above, South Arabian forms, I believe are later. Phoenician forms are roughly 3,000. This is this is a version of a griffin / Sphinx. This is around 3,000 years ago. Yeah. For a lot of these things, they're off by hundreds of years between the two of them, but it doesn't mean there weren't any earlier, just we don't necessarily have any extant examples of it.
Yeah, but the point is these all predate the Torah.
No, some of them are later. But yes, some of them predate.
The Egyptian ones.
Egyptian ones. Correct, they do. We'll get to a more specific example of that in just a second. Right? So again, is that a problem? So one question comes down to, so where on earth did they pull these out of? Right? Where do they think of these things? Right? So then if you were to read the beginning of the Rambam Hilchot Avodah Zarah, who describes the progression from everybody recognizing God to their being distracted by things they saw in nature or in the celestial bodies, and in turn switching from worshiping God to worshiping the celestial beings or the physical beings that they see around them because they thought it was like God, and they switch from worshiping God directly to worshiping them instead. So in that vein, it's entirely possible that, as you know, in Yechezkel's heavenly chariot, all of the animals depicted here in their various forms were seen as part of the heavenly chariot, right? There were wings similar to these things. There were lions. There were bulls. There were like a lot of the physical descriptions, right? They're in common. So there's always this possibility that simply this is their corruption of, you know, having once served God and then they, you know, deviated and started worshiping what human beings' perception of angels, because obviously it's going to be limited because angels are non-physical, are non-corporeal beings. So it's entirely possible that simply they, you know, got mixed up and they started worshiping what somebody had perceived as part of the heavenly chariot. So to address this, so I'd like to quote Rabbi Professor Joshua Berman. He's a professor of Bible at Bar-Ilan University. So the article that I'm going to be quoting from is "Was There an Exodus?" in Mosaic Magazine. Link here if you want it. Also, he's written a lot of books on the topic of biblical criticism, such as Animamin, where he deals with faith that doesn't come up with it. So here we're going to go through an approach to how do you deal with the conflict between seemingly the predating of a concept that is throughout the Jewish world, throughout the Torah, and yet it seemingly is predated by, you know, the Egyptians or somebody else. So this we're gonna, so as I mentioned earlier about the about the Rambam, right? There's a debate between the Rambam and the Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, as to whether initially you wanted did God always intend to give us korbanot, or do we only get korbanot because that's what we were used to, and God operated within what the worldview that we knew, but ideally that shouldn't have been the case. So the Rambam says that korbanot are only bidi-eved, they're not ideal. Better it would have been if it just only done through prayer, but what could you do? The Jews were used to sacrifice they had to have sacrifice. On the other hand, we have Nachmanides, the Ramban, who says that no, that was always the intention, just, you know, the fact that the non-Jews, you know, in between the time of you know, Adam Rishon and Noah and Avram, they decided to take it, so even for idolatrous purposes, doesn't make it bad anymore, it just means that they stole it. So we can take it back, no problem. So now let's get more into what I mean by there being some conflict with Kruvim specifically. So here we have in front of you, this is the throne tent of Ramses II. As you see that there are winged falcons flanking his cartouche. So you see all the way down here, right? So this is his military encampment, describing his military exploits and how great and awesome he is. So if you look at it, it's very busy. There's a lot of his chariots, again, which are soon going to be drowned by God at Kriyat Yam Suf, which we'll see in just a moment what's going on with that. So, but first I want to focus in on this section right here. Okay? So this section right here. Okay, so again, Ramses II is he is the king immediately, according to, again, depends on which opinion you're thinking of, but may have been immediately, you know, within the century prior to the Jews leaving Egypt. Again, the exact dating of leaving Egypt is also a debate. So again, according to many scholars, right, Ramses II slightly predates either the king during which the Jews escape, or the one shortly prior to that, for the Jews leaving Egypt. So I can point out here that there's this nice large structure, right? This nice encampment around here. Then there are people bowing down over here in a small box. And then they are here again. This cartouche over here is representing of the Pharaoh Ramses II. This is his name. And then here there are these winged beings, these winged falcons on the side of it. Okay, so now I'd also like to point out, this is what Professor Berman points out, is that note the, as far as dimensions go, scaled. So if you scaled proportionally, here's a depiction of the Mishkan, and here's one of the Ramses II's camp. Here is the size of this is the Ohel Moed, and here is the Kodesh. Here we have Ohel Moed, the Kodesh, and the Kodesh Kodeshim. Here we have the tent of Ramses, or the overall large encampment, his personal reception tent, and his chamber. And again, go back to see what do these birds look like. In case you're having a hard time remembering what it looked like, there's a lot of. So this is a better one. Does that look similar at all? Maybe. I'm sure you've also seen some versions of the Aron that look. Here, do it. Wait, they have it here. No, they're not here. We've seen certain versions of the Kruvim where they look just like that, right? Again, with baby faces, but that's what the Kruvim look like, right? They have their hands outstretched towards each other, facing each other, right? Standing on the sides, and also note that they look like they're standing on some sort of something, right? So the question is, so what are you going to do with this very deliberate looking parallel, right? This is a little bit too much of a coincidence for it to say that, oh yeah, there's like, you know, there's no connection. It's like dimensions are the same. Some of the imagery is the same. And there is, you know, and it is a encampment, you know, from roughly the same time period. So what's going on here? So Professor Berman puts forth that what is going on here? That God is deliberately reclaiming and changing the military encampment of the Egyptians to be and transforming it into what will later become the Jewish camp, right? Taking what the Jews are familiar with and transforming it into something divine, right? From the, you know, propaganda and totalitarian regime of the Pharaoh, and instead switching it into that of becoming the dwelling place for God. So while yes, that may be controversial, but as we mentioned that Rambam says about Korbanot in general, so it wouldn't be the largest stretch to say that it's not limited just to Korbanot, but it could be other aspects of it as well, could also have been based on what the Jews were used to and transforming it and sanctifying it into a proper direction.
So he'd have a problem according to the Ramban, probably, because the Ramban obviously had a different mahalach, and also he couldn't point to Avraham and Noach making these Kruvim. So I think the Ramban is on a little harder territory with the existence of the Kruvim.
Correct. But you could also argue that conversely, because true, there's no previous proof. But again, for all we know, that, you know, the Egyptians, you know, someone mentioned before about the development of idolatry, that they could have, you know, seen at some point that there was an actual prophet who served God, who saw God's heavenly chariot and saw God's encampment and tried to copy it and then wound up with something similar. And because we don't have, just when we don't have this, it didn't necessarily happen. And so, like, you could, again, not a good proof, but that could be a response for the Ramban. Okay. So now just want to point out, there is one image that kind of looks like it's a griffin in Tanakh, pointed out by Rabbi Natan Slifkin. So here, this is in the seventh chapter of Daniel, because Daniel has a lot of interesting prophecies. So here, this is about, there's four beasts referring to four future kingdoms. So one of these is that the first was like a lion, but had eagle's wings. And as I looked on, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted off the ground and set on its feet like a man and given the mind of a man. So what does that mean? Okay, so first thing first is, so we're going to look at Rashi, because Rashi makes this make a lot more sense, right? So again, so as far as this looking like a griffin, body of a lion, wings of an eagle, right, definitely fits the bill. So why is the, you know, are we plucking the wings off of the off of this griffin looking thing and then making it into like a boring human man? So Rashi says that this first one was like a lion and it had the wings of an eagle. So it was like a lion and it had the wings of an eagle. That is the kingdom of Babylon, which was ruling at the time. So did Jeremiah see a lion has come up from his thicket, and he says also, like an eagle, he shall soar. So the point being here is that, yes, we saw that, again, Assyrian, Egyptian, probably also Babylonian, they had this type of animal and it represented strength for them. So we see here that God is literally plucking that represents their kingdom and their form of strength, and God is instead turning it on its head and showing that actually, no, it is not strong, it's actually weak. Right? God's the one who's really in control, and you think you have this almighty kingdom, but actually God's going to come in and destroy it and turn it back into nothing. So if you look at Daniel, that's a lot of the prophecies kind of sound like that. So here we see that the composite in sections of the lion and that of the eagle, which each have their own imagery. And if anybody wants one on eagles, I'll happily, or when Nesher is, we'll hopefully do that in a future session. So point is that God is overtaking whatever power that Babel had and wiping it out. So again, where did they get that idea from? Again, that's what I said earlier, but here it's clear that whatever power may have been, or deity they've been worshiping, God is showing his dominance over said deity or said representation that they thought was powerful. Okay, so now let's quickly do some review over what we've covered. Again, and then feel free to ask any questions on what we've covered so far or anything that came up that was related. Okay, so as far as what did the cherub, the Kruvim, look like? So based on what we saw in Tanakh, we saw that they have wings, multiple faces, that they're types of angels, and they're also part of the heavenly chariot. We noted that the Gemara points out that their faces are specifically that of children, and that Unkla says that their bodies were as well. And then we noted that we've looked at what griffins were. We saw that they were most likely mythological in origin as far as what came first. Were the angels first before they became part of mythology? It's a good question. Don't really have a good answer for that one. And then we discuss the concept of what was in terms of Korbanot being ideal, how that relates to it. So we mentioned the Rambam saying that Korbanot were never ideal. We just got it because it's what we were used to at the time. We had the Ramban Nachmanides saying that was always intended, but simply the idolatry is still in the middle. And lastly, we had Professor Berman's argument that it doesn't really matter which one, whether or not, even if it had been purely from an idolatry's perspective, because The goal is God's taking that of the idolaters and turning it on his head, showing you that the point being that God's in charge. So true, it may have been entirely idolatrous origin, but once God decides that I'm going to turn it holy, doesn't matter what it was, but that would be that, you know, God can do that, but you or I shouldn't be, you know, trying to grab another religion's imagery and deciding that it's mine. Okay. Anybody have any questions?
Yeah, isn't it kind of strange the Rambam didn't use that reason by the Kruvim like it did by the Korbanos? Does it strike you as being strange?
I mean, it does, but it's more because there was no, as far as the Rambam knew, you would have had to have a reason to think that it went from one to the other, idolaters, non-idolaters. You've never seen the, if you haven't seen the inside of the Pharaoh's tomb that has to look very much like the Mikdash, you wouldn't have had that question.
Okay, so you're saying he may not have seen what you just showed us.
Correct. Odds are he didn't, because they only discovered it, you know, was it 150 years ago? So odds are, and it was, so meaning, so then that was, a lot of these things, like, again, it's possible that it's very unlikely that anybody knew about it in the interim between like when the person first made it and that and the century around then. And then, you know, the 3,000 years was under the sand, odds are, or under the earth, odds are nobody really knew about it. Okay. Unless we have evidence otherwise. That's generally the assumption.
I'm interested in something you touched on today, maybe for a future topic, and that's depicting of the star and moon and sun and the like. Because I think that for practical reasons, that is actually could be quite important.
Okay, happy to do that in the future also. So would you like that one? We could try that in, I guess, 2 weeks then. So I'll have to. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.